Hi folks, it's Sam Cedar. Today is Thursday, December 23rd, and we have a great, great Majority Report archive for you. I am in Michigan visiting the in-laws for the holidays. There's snow on the ground here, and let's just be honest. Emotions are frayed, and there's a lot of old wounds being opened up, and I am just sitting on the sidelines watching it all. So in the meantime, I'm not in New York City or doing my show, and so I have an archive for you from the Cedar on Sunday book shows. It is Lawrence Leggett, Lessig, and hold on for 1 second, sweetheart, please. Please, I'm talking to thousands of people. It is Wolf in Spanish is Lobo? Isn't it Lobo?
Yeah, okay. Wolf is Lobo.
And excuse me, Lobo. I'm sorry, you didn't need to hear that. One of the things I wanted to make sure that you knew from this podcast was that Wolf is Lobo in Spanish. And we have Lawrence Lessig and we have Paul Krugman on his book, The Liberal of a Conscience. This is back from beginning of 2008, both interesting interviews I think you'll enjoy. Tomorrow we'll have a couple more segments from a book show, and I will play what I consider my best appearance on television ever, and of course it was in service of the war on Christmas. So enjoy and have a good Christmas, and if you want to become a Majority Report member, now is a great time to do it, because it's now. So head over to majorityreport.fm or majority.fm. You can go to either one, same place, become a member, and hey, why not buy some coffee for the New Year's at Just Coffee, justcoffee.coop. Put in Majority, get a 10% discount. Okay, folks, enjoy.
The seventh day, God rested, and Cedar worked. It's Cedar on Sundays.
It is hour three, ladies and gentlemen, of Cedar on Sundays. Our number, 866-303-2270. It is a real pleasure to welcome back to the program. I think we spoke to him on the Majority Report, nevertheless, Lawrence Lessig is a professor of law at Stanford Law School. He is the founder of Stanford's Center for Internet and Society, as well as the Creative Commons Project. For his latest project, he is lending his technological tools to the fight against government corruption. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Glad to be here.
Now, I want to start with what you've been working on for the past, I guess, at least 10 years of your life. How that brought to you to how you want to spend the next 10 years of your life. But tell me a little bit about the notion of Creative Commons. What exactly is it, and why did you develop this new classification for intellectual property?
Well, to see that, you got to take one step back and look at the way copyright law interacts with digital technologies. So copyright law basically regulates any time you make a copy. In the world before digital technologies, that didn't matter much. You could go through your whole life never really making the kind of copy copyright law worried about. But in the world of digital technologies, basically every time you do anything with culture, you trigger copyrights regulation. And what a bunch of us saw about 10 years ago was that this is going to create the perfect storm for conflict between regulation of copyright law and the potentials of digital technologies. So what Creative Commons did was that, we launched this nonprofit just 5 years ago to give people a simple way to mark their creative work with the freedoms they intended to carry, as opposed to the restrictions which copyright law says. So it builds on top of copyright law, but what it says is rather than all rights reserved, basically some rights reserved, and the rights that are given up are rights that people have to share your work or to build upon your work consistent with, you know, what your interest, what reason you have to make your work available. So it's really a kind of private alternative to the existing copyright system that literally millions of works are now available under, and therefore available to be mixed and shared, consistent with the law, but without any lawyers standing in the middle.
Will you just speak a little bit about how you perceive that the introduction of digital technology has moved us from a read-only to a read-write type of system in terms of the way we deal with, I guess, content?
Yeah, so you can think of the 20th century as the couch potato century, right? So these technologies that were born really just at the beginning of the 20th century to make culture accessible, broadly accessible, but basically all you did was consume professionally created culture, that you bought or you got access to in a film theater or across the radio. So we became this kind of couch potato culture in the sense that we had extraordinary choice, but we didn't really participate in the creation or the recreation of the culture that we consumed. We just basically consumed it. Well, digital technologies have now given a revival, a rebirth to the way culture was, you know, for basically the whole of human history before the 20th century, where people are much more active in the creation and recreation, the sharing of their culture, than they were during the 20th century. So, you know, when I was growing up, the cool thing to do was to make a mixed tape, but my kids are going to make remixes of the music they listen to. That's the way they're going to show their skill or their insight about music. They're not going to be satisfied with just the idea of making some stupid selection of songs for a tape. So this is because digital technologies have given people this power, really, to do things with culture that they weren't able to before. And that's what's revived what I think of as this read-write culture in many contexts, in politics most importantly.
Now, I watched the PowerPoint presentation that you gave, I guess, at TED, which is a, I'm not even quite sure I know what it is, but I know that I had access to watching it for the first time. But you mentioned that the economy of influence will not allow government to exercise common sense or allow common sense to enter into the intellectual property debate. Tell me about what economy of influence is, and if that's not the jumping off point as to how you've decided to commit the next 10 years of your life.
Yeah, so that's exactly why I've changed my focus. So by economy of influence, I mean to refer to, you know, what some people would call corruption, but by corruption I don't mean, you know, somebody paying a congressman to vote in a certain way, or even somebody saying, okay, I'll give you $10,000 for your campaign if you vote in a certain way. But instead, it's what we're all familiar with in the way Washington functions. People with a lot of money to give campaigns have much better access to the political candidates or to members of Congress than people who don't. And what that means is Congress's attention is focused on these issues, which are of very importance to relatively small but powerful group of people, and they don't either see the other side or they don't care about the other side because the other side doesn't give them the kind of resources they need. So in the context of copyright, anybody who looks at this without their paycheck depending upon the models of distribution of the 20th century, anybody who looks at it, you know, recognizes that copyright's important. It's got to remain in the 21st century as a central part of the creative economy. But it's got to change radically, given the way digital technologies have radically changed how we get access to our culture. But Congress is not focused at all on how to update copyright law to the 21st century. They've passed, in my count, 22 new laws in the last 10 years designed to further regulate or further criminalize activities around copyrighted material to defend business models from the 20th century. Now, that's because, you know, Hollywood and powerful industries, including the recording industry, get Congress's ear. They get, you know, they bring movie stars in or recording stars to testify on the Hill, and everybody shows up to their hearings. And Congress doesn't even understand the other side to the issue. And so as I began to recognize that, you know, we've been making a lot of progress in the public but not in Congress, it was because Congress is not really able to hear issues that don't have a lot of money next to them. And that's a fundamental problem in the way our government functions.
You know, as I think about the notion of this economy of influence not allowing common sense to enter into the debate on intellectual property, you can obviously draw parallels in almost every different arena that government deals with, whether it's healthcare or energy consumption and independence in this country. And so this is what has led you to this commitment. Tell me about your commitment now for the next 10 years.
Well, you're exactly right. I mean, when I began to hit my head against the wall in the context of copyright, you know, I then began to notice that it was the same thing happening in a whole bunch of different contexts. So think of global warming. You know, the issues around global warming, about, you know, whether there is global warming and whether humans are responsible for it, are not hard issues. They've not been hard issues for at least the last 8 years. You know, our government has done nothing really at all to address this issue, and especially during this current administration, not because the science is uncertain, but because all the money in the world is against our government dealing with this, because the oil companies are keenly focused on avoiding anybody taking this issue seriously. Or think about nutrition. You know, our government tells our kids that 25% of their diet can come from sugar. That's radically inconsistent with what any nutritionist would tell you. Yet that's what our government says, because the sugar industry has been so powerful in influencing the Food Nutrition Board, which sets daily recommended allowances for various food intakes. So you can look at a wide range of these issues where you see that money is corrupting how government is addressing these important issues. And if these issues were not important, you might say, well, you know, this is what we expect of government. But the problem is, these are some of the most important issues we face today. And my view was, unless we could find a way to get government to fix government, to change this way that government functions or doesn't function, we were not going to be able to deal with or solve any of these basic issues in any time soon. So I launched this work, which is, you know, basically begins as academic work, but I hope turns into something of a movement, but with a recognition that it's going to take many, many years, and it's going to take people outside the political process, not politicians inside the political process, because they depend on the existing system, even if they hate it, and they're not likely to take steps to change it in any radical way.
There's something fundamentally anti-democratic with the way that this economy of influence works, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we give people votes. They're supposed to have one vote, and yet the effective money here is to distort that vote so that there's votes plus money, and money, of course, is radically unequally distributed.
I just had an IMer who sent me this just in the context of my last conversation regarding the immunization for telecommunications companies that helped the government to illegally spy on Americans. And the IMer suggested that, in fact, in some ways, we have a de facto third party in this country, it being the corporatist, if you will, in that they'll support Democrats or Republicans as long as they carry out this agenda, which maybe on its face does not appear to be ideological. I mean, do you think that's an accurate description?
Yeah, I do. And I think it's because, you know, companies are facing ferocious competition in the world today. And one of the easiest ways to beat competition is to use government to protect yourself. That's historically what's always been the case, but it's really quite pressing right now. And business is very adept at, you know, changing its face to suit the current party in power. So when the Democrats were out of power, you know, we all looked to the Democrats to make the revolutionary change that we want. But, you know, when the Democrats get in power, it's I'm afraid it's business as usual. And even the Democratic Party, you can see, is fundamentally divided between people who want to see a radical change. I think Obama and Edwards would certainly be the leaders on that side. And people, you know, who kind of like the way the system functions. I think Hillary Clinton is on that side. And that division, I think, is the fundamental division that we want to exploit in building this new movement.
I couldn't agree with you more on that assessment. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, I want to hear more about what you're doing and exactly the mechanics of it and how you see this issue playing out. What after the academics are done and we begin to move this into a movement, what are the mechanics that will take us there? We got to take a break. We're talking to Professor Lawrence Lessig of Stanford Center for Internet and Society, as well as the Creative Commons Project. We'll be right back.
It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
We are back on the phone. Professor Lawrence Lessig, a professor of law at Stanford Law School. He's the founder of Stanford's Center for Internet and Society, sits on the board of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and the founder of the Creative Commons Project, found at creativecommons.org. You can also check out lessig.org, L-E-S-S-I-G.org. And this is sort of the epicenter, I guess, of your attempts to begin to look into this economy of influence, the corruption of our representative government, that money has played in that respect. So, Professor, what are the next steps that you're taking? And do you have a game plan as to how to follow this out?
You know, I don't have a complete game plan. I think I know that two main steps that are going to be taken. One seems kind of obvious and not very controversial. One's going to sound a little bit insane. So the obvious non-controversial one is that we're going to leverage digital technologies to making government a lot more transparent and making it easier to track what's actually going on with money. Already there's some fantastic sites out there doing that. Check out maplight.org, maplight.org. They've got this fantastic system for, you know, at the issue level, or even at the bill level, you can see who gave money and how people voted as a result of the money given, and even the timing of the money given relative to votes. So you can see all of a sudden a whole bunch of money came in, and then Congress voted on it, and they happened to vote it in the way that the money wanted. So this makes, you know, this transparency is going to be very good at creating a lot of recognition and pressure around this issue. So that's the part that's kind of obvious, and I think is going to be the most important stuff to be doing the next, you know, chunk of time, next 5 years probably. But I actually think the long run here has got to be a change which comes from outside the system. And whether that's a constitutional change that comes not from Congress, but our Constitution gives we the people a power to change without depending on Congress, or a change from the states, but it's got to be a change that pretty radically alters the economy of influence of the way Congress functions. But I think that's going to take a while to sort of build recognition of this, and so that's why, in fact, you're the first person I've ever discussed that idea with.
Well, we have broken some news, and
yeah.
So and would that deal with how we elect our officials?
No, I think the key thing is to change how officials play the game of getting elected. So right now, you know, Congress people, most of whom, you know, go into this because they want to try to do good in the world, spend a huge amount of their time just protecting themselves, raising money to protect themselves in their incumbency, or, you know, gerrymandering districts to protect themselves in their incumbency, but doing everything they can to make sure that they don't really face any real competition in the election system. So there's solutions like, you know, campaign financing, which would, you know, reduce the amount of time that they have to spend raising money. Then there are ideas like Bruce Ackerman and Ian Ayers have this fantastic proposal and really well implemented set of details around it for trying to make anonymous the relationship between money and who it goes to. So you're still allowed to give, for example, $10,000 to a candidate, but there would be no credible way for the candidate to know that you were the person who gave the $10,000. Just like, you know, before voting was anonymous, it used to be that people voted in public, made it easy to buy votes because you could see somebody voted in the way they said they'd vote. But after anonymous voting came in, that, you know, connection between buying votes and results wasn't really possible. And so Ayers and Ackerman's idea is to do the same thing with campaign finance, campaign contributions. So, you know, I think there are a bunch of these solutions we ought to think about towards the end of improving the influences that lead to our Congress being the way our Congress will be.
Professor Lawrence Lessig, thank you so much for joining us. It's Lessig.org. We'll be following your work with great interest. Thanks again for talking to us. 866-303-2270.
Cedar on Sundays.
We are back on the telephone. Paul Krugman is professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University and columnist for the New York Times. His new book is The Conscience of a Liberal. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hi there.
So now most of us are aware of the Great Depression, I hope, and the subsequent New Deal that came out of that time period. You write extensively about the Great Compression. Explain to me when that was, what it was, and what the implications are or were for American politics at that time.
Okay, so the Great Compression is something that takes place between the mid-1930s and the mid-1940s, and it's the creation of middle-class America. Before then, the Gilded Age never really ended until the New Deal came along. The extreme inequality, concentration of wealth in the hands of a few people, most Americans sharing only marginally in the country's prosperity. And then it all changes. It changes in a very short period of time. The middle-class society of post-war America, you know, the country I grew up in, is something that was created, and it was created politically during the Roosevelt years, by the New Deal. It's as important in shaping the country we became as the Great Depression, as the Great Slump of the 1930s, but you don't hear about it so much. And it's a crucial phase in American history. It tells you that middle-class societies don't just happen. You need to have political leaders who make them happen.
So what were the implications on our, I guess, the political landscape at that time? I mean, we had a period of time where you had this sort of rock-solid middle class where nobody was fantastically wealthy, but everybody had a sense of financial security that if they continued to play by the rules, I guess is the classic phrase, play by the rules and work hard, that they were going to be able to afford to educate their children, to be able to feed themselves, to have a good retirement. What were the implications of that on the political environment?
Well, there was a long period when there were conservatives who bitterly fought against all those institutions, who fought against Social Security, who wanted to revoke the labor laws that made it possible to organize unions, who fought against the minimum wage, but they kept losing elections. And in Conscience of a Liberal, I talk about what really happened in 1948. You know, everybody knows that Harry Truman went on the campaign trail and people said, "Give him hell, Harry," and he won this fantastic upset victory. Who was he giving hell, and what was he giving him hell about? And the answer is he was giving Republicans who wanted to turn back the clock on the New Deal hell, and the public voted against that. What followed was a period, a long period, of real bipartisanship in which the Republican Party of the time moderated its position. Dwight Eisenhower would have been considered a socialist by modern standards. He presided over very high tax rates on the rich. He wrote to his brother that people who thought you could undo Social Security were stupid. That lasted for a long time. People liked the new middle-class America that came out of the New Deal. And then, of course, a lot of the story of the book is how that both that political consensus and the middle-class society came apart.
Yeah, I want to get to that, and that obviously almost starts out of sort of the Goldwater era,
right,
which of course is referenced in the title of your book, his The Conscience of a Conservative, yours, yeah, The Conscience of a Liberal. But before we get there, you talk about that the New Deal was a function of the Great Depression. So you had this horrible economic situation that presaged and almost gave a catalyst to the New Deal. But what were the forces that led to the Gilded Age? Just so that people understand really what we were looking at then, because there's a lot of people who will make comparisons between that time and today, or at least where we're headed.
mature. I mean, the Gilded Age, which really lasted longer, you know, it lasted well into the 20th century, is this period when a few people, robber barons, captains of industry, a lot of railroad magnates, financial operators, and so on, accumulated vast wealth and got the support or a free ride from government. They paid minimal taxes. They often got privileges in terms of land grants and favorable government policies. And you might have asked, a question you might ask is, why didn't the American public demand at least some sharing of the wealth? Why wasn't there some demand for that these people pay for some security for what was a really often very downtrodden workforce? And the answer is, and this is where the Gilded Age starts to remind you of modern America, for a variety of reasons, our paper democracy didn't work so democratically in practice. Huge monetary advantages. When populists would run for office, they'd be outspent 10-1 by conservative opponents. A lot of vote fraud, a lot of vote buying, actually. It was even more widespread than it is now, and ethnic and religious and racial divisions. A lot of people had common interests. Black sharecroppers in the South and small white farmers in the South, farmers in general and the urban working class, but they couldn't get along with each other, and many of them were effectively disenfranchised, both the immigrant workers in the cities and the southern non-white voters.
And I would add to that, too, I think a Supreme Court that had there been a legislative will to protect workers or to sort of even the playing field, they probably would have struck it down as well.
Well, all through the teens and the 20s, when state legislatures in some places passed what amounted to early versions of unemployment compensation or early versions of Social Security, they'd be declared unconstitutional. And, of course, Roosevelt had that problem, too. So, sure, even when occasionally more populist, more democratically inclined in the economic sense, people got some political leverage, they would find that the judicial system, which was long-term controlled by conservatives, stood in their way.
So we have a situation where, you know, and I expressed that the idea, and I think it's fairly conventional wisdom that the idea of that the political will, I guess, and the political changes that brought about the New Deal was a function of the economic reality of the Great Depression. But you write in your book that you are increasingly convinced that the opposite is now true or has always been true, that in fact political changes affect the economy.
Well, yeah, I mean, those are different stories. The Depression offered the opportunity. It discredited the right-wing ideology of the time. But when you look at the rise and fall of inequality in the United States, or actually the fall and rise, you see politics very much part of it. The Great Compression, as already described, was a political event. Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal, they made us a middle-class nation. It didn't just happen. It was made so by political action. Then you look at the things that have happened in these last 30 years as we've moved into a second Gilded Age. You look at something like the decline of unions. People think that that was, well, that had to happen. That was automatic. The world economy changed. But other countries have not seen anything like the implosion of the union movement we've seen. Canada still has more than 30% of its workers in unions. What happened in America was that primarily the Reagan administration declared open season for union busters. So it's actually in many ways, to a large extent, it's political change that has driven this change in the economy towards this extremely unequal society we now have once again.
So in some sense, and tell me if I'm taking this too far, but the inequality that we see today is a result of a concerted effort to achieve this inequality.
Yeah, I think that's basically right. It's not usually phrased that way. The way that the movement conservatives, they say, you know, we need to undo the effects of the New Deal and the Great Society, which were fundamentally un-American. They were socialist, and we need to get rid of that. But everything they do has, when you try to figure out who wins, who loses, has the effect of promoting inequality.
We are talking to Paul Krugman about his new book, The Conscience of a Liberal. Stay tuned for the second half of our conversation right after the break.
Sam Cedar. He puts the truth inside your radio. Sam Cedar on Air America Radio.
It's the Cedar on Sundays book show. My guest today, Paul Krugman, is professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University and columnist for the New York Times. His new book, The Conscience of a Liberal. So if you have the situation where you're coming out of the Great Compression is in existence, and you have this this middle class that is feeling financially secure, and at the same time we also see a rise in an appropriation of the middle class of more political power. And certainly, you know, if you're a college student at that time, you go out and protest because you're not as concerned about maybe whether or not you're going to have a job because there's this overall sense of financial security.
Yeah, and you can see it in reverse, too. If you want to ask what really ended the counterculture in America, a lot of it was the Nixon recession of 1969. All of a sudden, college-age kids were saying, maybe it isn't a guarantee that I can find a job after all. So sure, but it was an empowered time in a lot of ways. Not for everybody, obviously. Not if you were a woman. Not if you were, for most of the period, not if you were non-white. But if you were a working American, you felt that you were pretty secure. You had in many cases, you had a union to back you up. It was a more democratic time with a small d in economics, and because of that in politics.
And certainly women and certainly blacks in this country did not achieve their rights, or in the case of simply the voting rights for black people in 1965. But what you do have during that time is this building of this political will and dissatisfaction and the ability to express it because of this compression. So my question to you is, was the agenda of creating this inequality, of creating the context for this inequality, motivated by a desire for a very small people to have more money, and or for a desire to lessen the political strength and the political expression of the vast majority of the people in this country?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it is about money. If you really try to ask who pays for the institutions of conservatism, who pays for the Heritage Foundation, it's paid for by a small group of very wealthy families who provide the seed money, and then to a large extent now by corporate donations. And these are people who basically don't think that rich people should pay taxes, and they don't believe that that they should be obliged to do things like help pay for a safety net that provides health care for less lucky people. So it is mostly economic. There is an underlying undemocratic streak. One of the things I do in the Conscience of a Liberal is I quote from articles that were written in National Review. Go back to the 1950s before they learned to disguise a little bit better what they were up to. And it's amazing to see how much their true hero, the guy they really admired, was Generalissimo Francisco Franco of Spain, who defended Spain's soul against the grotesque regime otherwise known as Spain's democratically elected government. So there is a strong undemocratic streak, but I think you want to think of it as mostly about greed, and whatever political weakening of the majority comes as sort of icing on the cake. So you don't have to imagine that there's a great vision. It's all part of a giant master plan. It's mostly that the restraints have been taken off. Maintaining a middle-class society takes work. You have to have unions that empower workers and limit the ability of the rich to get what they want. You have to have a climate in which which Congress will hold hearings in the case of real outrageous abuses of economic power. You have to have an environment in which people have a safety net. They have unemployment insurance, which makes them more able to bargain with employers when they have Social Security, so they know what their retirement will look like. So take away all those things, and you have a situation in which the people who have the right connections, who have the inside track, get to take a much bigger share of the economic pie.
Does this, and I assume this perpetuates itself, because once you amass that type of power in the form of money, you can continue the process even more.
Well, there's a lot of that. I mean, you can see that there's a kind of mutually reinforcing process that goes on in the last 30 years in which the rich have gotten richer and as a result have come to dominate campaign finance even more, and that as a result have increased their power. There's a kind of a spiral involved. You know, I will say, however, I mean, that this is an optimistic book in the end, because I think there is a building backlash among the public, but we certainly have gone seen this, the return to a gilded age, both economically and politically.
We started off this interview by reminding me that there is a way forward offered by your book, and a lot of that centers around health care. Why is universal health care or the health care debate, why is that so important to regaining some of the a second age of the Great Compression, if you will?
Well, first of all, because it is itself something that we really ought to do. It's a moral imperative. No other rich country lets its citizens go without necessary health care. Because they can't afford it or be ruined by the financially ruined by the expenses of needed health care. This is something we ought to be doing, and it's something we can do. It's actually cheaper to have a system that covers everybody than to have our current system, in which the insurance industry spends a lot of money trying to figure out who needs health care so as not to give them policies. But it's also, it is because the economics of health care are so good, the economics of doing it right, are so good because the moral advantages of doing it right are so good. Success on healthcare would do a lot to reinvigorate, re-legitimize the whole, what I think of as the New Deal agenda, the whole project of trying to give us a more economically democratic society. And that's the opinion of people on the right. Famous memo from William Kristol of the Weekly Standard in the early 90s about the Clinton healthcare plan saying we have to kill this thing because if it succeeds, then this will, in fact, bring new energy, new life to the New Deal agenda. And so we have to make sure that it fails. And, you know, I agree on the judgment. If you can get health care reform, it does wonders for the whole sense of what it is we should be doing with this country.
So fundamentally, a successful health care program would essentially re-legitimize the notion that government, what government's supposed to do for people and that it can do it effectively.
Yeah, in other rich countries, you'll hear complaints about government, but you never hear the kind of, oh, government can't do anything right that you hear in the United States. And partly that's because in the United States, conservatives have managed to prevent the government from doing the things that government does really well. Among those is provision of health insurance. That's one of those areas that once you've got that, people really appreciate it, and it becomes a demonstration. I mean, the famous story in the healthcare area, to health policy, you know, we've had this constant propaganda that government does everything wrong, and yet there are some government programs that people really love, and sometimes they get confused. So there's the story of the constituent who chased the senator down the corridors of an airport, yelling, "Senator, don't let the government get its hands on Medicare." So, you know, this is. But the point, of course, is if we did have national guarantee of healthcare, it would be a big demonstration. We changed the whole tone of political discussion in this country.
What does it mean to be a partisan, and why do you feel it's important for you to be one?
Okay, right now, we need change. We need change in a progressive direction in this country. You can't get that change by looking for some middle ground between the parties. There actually isn't any middle ground. You've got a Republican Party that is, for the time being, at least controlled by a movement that wants to dismantle not extend and improve the legacy of the New Deal, but dismantle it. Any change has got to come from within the Democratic Party, and it's going to require, it's going to have to win elections. So for the time being, at least, being a progressive means being a partisan.
Well, that's a great place to end. Paul Krugman, Professor of Economics and International Affairs at Princeton University, columnist for the New York Times. His new book, The Conscience of a Liberal, is available everywhere. It's a great read, folks. Please enjoy it. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you so much.
Well, folks, I hope you've enjoyed this special Super Bowl book show edition of Cedar on Sundays. We'll be back live next week to recap this really important week coming up, when more delegates will be awarded to presidential candidates in one day than ever before. I'm talking, of course, about Super Tsunami Tuesday. And if you live in one of those states, don't forget to get out there and make your voice heard. This contest isn't decided yet, not by a long shot, so get out and vote. And then, tune in next week for Cedar on Sundays when I'll be taking your calls on the primary and what's going on with FISA, on the economy, and anything else you want to talk about. That's next Sunday with Cedar on Sundays. In meantime, check out SamCedarShow.com.